I will wait for you. Thank you very much. Good morning and welcome everybody. Happy 2023 to all the honorable members here at M46 and on the virtual. I want to welcome the public protector and her legal team in the resumption of our inquiry. You welcome public protector and your legal team. To also acknowledge our evidence leaders, Advocate Bawan Mayosi, to welcome members of the media with us as we start our session in 2023, the entire support staff, and a special welcome to members of the public who probably would have felt a very long holiday and break, couldn't wait to restart. We are back. But let me also acknowledge, and I hope that we will to acknowledge Ms. Sokoni, who would have been with us in our last session. You would have taken an oath. You're still under oath. We're not going to repeat that. Thank you very much and welcome. Today, dear colleagues, as we ended on the 5th of December, we are resuming our inquiry and we are still under the leadership of the Public Protector legal team in leading evidence of the remaining witnesses. I'm now going to take this opportunity to invite Advocate Mpofu to resume the leading of evidence with Ms. Sokoni, who would have been with us at the start of this inquiry. Quite a coincidence. And I hope that as Advocate Mpofu starts, I see quite a number of other guests joining. I'm not in a position to say who they are. She will be able to indicate that. But you're all welcome. Thank you very much. I can see he's still busy on social media. Over to you, Advocate Mpofu.
I missed that, Chairperson. Okay. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Chair. Good morning, everybody. And
let's pause.
Okay, there's music.
Somebody else. This time, go chabala la temfa kwako. It's sabotage this week.
Shavalala out of order. We will call the white shirts. No. Good morning, Chairperson, and good morning, members, and everyone, evidence leaders.
My apologies. Just a pause.
Sure.
I forgot both. I just forgot to indicate, colleagues, that we have Ms. Sokoni for today and tomorrow. And today will be a day dedicated and to the public protector team. We'll start now until the end of the day. So to indicate that if he doesn't need that, it will be a very good sign, would then start tomorrow with evidence leaders half a day and conclude with the members at the end of the day. You're indicating that you don't need much time.
Justin, I'm sorry to disappoint you. No, I'm indicating that I might need more time, Chairperson. But we can maybe offline, you and I, during tea, we'll talk about it and see if we can find each other. But on a serious note, Chairperson, it's my assessment is that we might even have to spill over, as I indicated in the letter, maybe to Wednesday. Obviously, it's not as a target, but if we'll talk over tea time. Well, Chair, I was just saying that I hope everyone had a good break, and I'm sure those who were in the conference, that its conference went well, and we are here to start on a fresh start. So, Chair, if I may, if you give me 1 minute, I had indicated to you via correspondence that there were certain issues that I wanted to address, which in our backroom meeting with the evidence leaders, we had hoped would save us a lot of time, not necessarily today or tomorrow, but I'm talking in general. You indicated in your letter, Chair, and I suppose that's confirmed by what I've just said about the witness, maybe even having to take longer. So I'm in a way agreeing with your approach, Chair, which was that such matters, insofar as they are not directly involving this particular witness, can be dealt with at the end of her evidence. So we will follow that wise approach from the Chair, so that even if we spill over, we don't overspill, so to speak. Yeah. So therefore, Chair, we will immediately start with the business of the day, and then we'll deal with our domestic issues once our guests have finished their business. Now, Chair, you correctly indicated that we have, I think one can say, in the world of public protectors or ombudsman, as the institution is known internationally, today we have the ombudsman royalty with us. And as you indicated, Chair, I'll introduce them. The first person I'll introduce is the one just next to me. That's Honorable Florence Kajuju. As you indicate, she was here earlier in these proceedings. She is an advocate herself. She's from Kenya. She's the former vice chair of LSK. I'll find out just now what that means. And she's the most important head. She has many, many heads, but the most important one is that she's the president of the IOI, which is the international body that effectively more than almost 140 countries now affiliate to. She has obviously herself has experience in this field, and we are deeply honored. We also were pleasantly surprised when she indicated that she could come today to give support to Honorable Sokoni. She's not alone. She's with the Miss Mercy Wambua, right? Yes, sitting next to her. She's the executive director of AOMA, which is the African version of it's the continental body. We'll talk about these structures when we lead the evidence chair in more detail. And she's also the CEO of CAJ. And the executive director, as we all know in those structures, is the person who runs the operations, which is basically the CEO. And then, of course, we have Honorable Sokoni, who's the public protector of Zambia, but also here wearing her cap as representing AHOMA. Although she'll also touch on the comparative issues of the public protector of Zambia, as indicated in her statement. And then, of course, last but not least, we have the public protector of South Africa, who is an active participant in all those structures and is an esteemed colleague of these. It looks like, Chair, a lot of us can learn a lot from these organizations, not just about ombudsman, but also about women empowerment.
Thank you. You are all welcome, both in South Africa and at this inquiry. Thank you very much, and thank you, Advocate Mbof.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, and as you indicated, Honorable Sokoni has already been sworn in. So this is the part where we deal with the formal evidence. Good morning, Honorable Sokoni.
Good morning.
How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, if you can try and speak up or closer to the mic.
There are two mics there. Is there a mic that side?
So you'd like them to both be on?
Because you'll be looking at him most of the time.
Yes. Perfect.
So that will be the mic that will read the other one on the other side. Or is there just one mic? Yes. So that we don't finish the day with a sore neck. Thank you. I hope it will work.
Actually, because I think it doesn't make a difference.
Are you well, madam?
Yes, very well, thank you.
Thank you. Welcome back. As the chair has indicated, I just want to firstly to indicate, and I'm sure it will be clear very soon after a few questions, the importance.
Just a pause.
Okay, sure.
We want her to be as comfortable as she can be, yes, trying to, so that she can shift the chair just towards that other mic.
Thank you. Is that comfortable?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Now, I was saying that it will become clear after a few questions that this is possibly one of the most important testimonies that will be given to this committee, because it's going to give us context. And you and I, as lawyers, we know that the catchphrase that says context is everything. So you're going to be giving us the historical context and the specific context of this important institution of democracy around the world. Now, I want to start by just going back in time, because you were here with us before, and remind you that we had the very first witness. I don't know if you were here for that witness or you were only here for Mr. Samuel, but the very first witness who testified here was a gentleman called Mr. Ibrahim, who in a way at least promised to give us some of the context that you are giving us. But it turned out that he said himself that he was not an expert. So that was the end of his usefulness for this purpose. But more importantly, he also said something which I would like to pose to you as the first question. He said, there are no experts in this field of ombudsman. He was trying to justify why he's just a constitutional expert, but there are no real experts. Is that true?
The institution of the ombudsman has existed for over 200 years. There's a lot of jurisprudence in that area. There's a lot of books that have been written on ombudsmanship. So we have a number of experts in Africa. We have our own Professor Ayeni. We have former ombudspersons like Justice Florence Mumba of Zambia, who has written a number of articles in a number of books regarding ombudsmanship. We have Professor Linda Reef, who has written a number of books on ombudsmanship. And there's a plethora of papers that have been written by a number of ombudsmen at different International Ombudsman Institute conferences, as well as African Ombudsman and Mediators Associations conferences. So I think that's my submission on that question.
Yeah. No, thank you. I'm sure Mr. Ibrahim was not deliberately misleading us or the committee, but I think that statement just underscores the fact that he, of his first admission that he himself was not an expert in the field. Otherwise, he would have been aware of those African and international experts in the field, correct?
That is correct.
Thank you. All right. Well, now that we have a real expert, we can try and demonstrate the extent of your expertise in this field. And I will take you immediately to your statement, which is at 213, I think. Sorry, I'll ask my colleague to help me to identify this. I know that the affidavit is bundle H, is 31.3. Am I right? Hi. There you are. Maybe just so that we don't go word for word on this, just to explain to those people, unlike the members who have seen the statement, just to explain to anyone else that the structure of your evidence is that you've given a short affidavit to which you have attached quite a detailed statement. And so we'll go through the affidavit just to really put everything in its proper context. But most of my questions will emanate from the statement itself. So could you then just give the committee briefly your academic qualifications first?
I have a Bachelor's of Laws degree. I have a Bachelor of Laws degree from the University of Zambia.
Recording stopped.
And a Master's of Law degree.
Recording in progress.
From the University of London. I have been ombudsman in the Republic of Zambia for the last 18 years, from 2004 to the present.
from 2004.
Yes, sir.
So next year you'll be 20 years in the office.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes. I have served as AOMA regional coordinator for Southern Africa. I served in that position for 4 years. I then served as AOMA treasurer for 2 years. And subsequently, I was also elected to the International Ombudsman Institute to sit as director on the board of directors. I served as IOI Africa director again for 4 years. And I currently serve as the IOI treasurer, that is the International Ombudsman Institute treasurer. The International Ombudsman Institute is the world body of ombudsman institutions. And its secretariat is housed in Vienna, Austria, by the Austrian Ombudsman. And the African Ombudsman and Mediators Association is the Africa-wide association of ombudspersons. It has been in existence since 1995, formally. Yes.
Okay, that's good. So it would be safe then to say that you have served the institution, and I mean broadly the ombudsman and institution, for a long time at a national level, at a continental level, as well as an international level.
That is correct.
Thank you. And you have held the position, some of which you have mentioned now and others which are covered in your statement.
Yes, that is correct.
All right. Now, can you then just tell the committee briefly about IOMA and IOI? You know, just briefly, what do they stand for? Not the letters. Well, you can also tell us about the letters IOI and AOMA, but broadly, what are those bodies? I think we have a fair idea of what the Public Protector of Zambia may be, because it's not much different to ours, and we will deal with the comparisons later. But those other institutions, if you can just introduce them to the committee.
Thank you so much. The International Ombudsman Institute was set up as way back as, I think, 1991.
Uh-huh.
And it was established in order to standardize the operations of ombudspersons worldwide. Also, to ensure protection for the institution of the ombudsman, because it is a very unique institution. It is not like no other human rights institution, because by its design, it is intended to investigate the very institutions that create it. So it was felt necessary to ensure that there was sufficient protection for the ombudsman in its operation, and also to have international recognition from the United Nations and other international regional bodies to extend the appropriate protection, and to establish appropriate standards for the operation of the ombudsman.
That's the IOI.
That is the IOI.
And AOMA?
For the African Ombudsman and Mediators Association, they actually started the operations initially by establishing a research institute at the University of Dar es Salaam. And when the institution of the Ombudsman in Tanzania became a hybrid institution investigating maladministration as well as human rights, it was felt that it was necessary to move the institution of the Ombudsman to a jurisdiction which was more reflecting more of classical Ombudsman style. That was the time, I think in 2005, that there was an African Ombudsman Association meeting, because initially the institution was called the African Ombudsman Association.
Uh-huh.
So when we met at Misty Hills in Johannesburg, it was there that the African Ombudsman Association was transformed to the African Ombudsman and Mediators Association to try and embrace also French-speaking Africa,
mm-hmm.
because in French-speaking countries, the institution of the Ombudsman is known, they refer to it as the Mediator.
Mm-hmm.
So the name was transformed from African Ombudsman Association to African Ombudsman Mediators Association, and the constitution amended. And it was at that point, actually, that we also started talking about the need to have standards, because it was noticed that there were a lot of ombudsman institutions that were not being properly recognized in their countries. They were not being accorded the proper protections.
Uh-huh.
And it was at that time that we started the discussion of the issue of drafting standards as to what sort of what sort of ombudsman institutions we needed in a constitutional democracy in Africa. A lot of the countries were establishing hybrid ombudsman institutions. And when I talk about a hybrid ombudsman institution, like I said, in Tanzania, they had to move away from Tanzania to South Africa because Tanzania had a hybrid ombudsman institution. A classical ombudsman institution has a single mandate, that is the investigation of maladministration.
Uh-huh.
And it is accountable to the legislature. And thirdly, and most importantly, its reports have the force of a recommendation. They are not binding.
Uh-huh.
Yes, please.
Thank you very much. And you'll forgive me, I'll be jumping between your statement and the affidavit so that we save time. So if you touch on something which I was going to touch on later, I'll wrap it up now so that when we get to that stage, we don't have to redo it. And I'm saying that apropos your statement which you just made now about French Africa. And so we might as well just deal with the terminology up front, because I'm sure some people who are not familiar with this field, which is new to us, you know, we're a young democracy, but sometimes we think highly of ourselves. But we might assume that people know that ombudsman means the same thing as public protector and so on. So I'll take you directly to paragraph 12 of your statement, which you will find at 31.3.2. And while they're putting it up, let me just ask you this question. It is indeed so that the ombudsman is a generic term, and each country uses whatever term pleases them, but they all fall under the generic description of ombudsman, and we'll get into the history, but can you just confirm that?
Yes, the term ombudsman is a Swedish term, meaning,
Swedish.
Yes,
uh-huh.
meaning a defender of rights or a people's protector.
Okay.
Yes. So different jurisdictions have then embraced the concept of the ombudsman,
mm-hmm.
but it's an institution that is for the vulnerable, for the least person who needs to hold government to account when an injustice has been occasioned against him. So it therefore became necessary, different jurisdictions recognized that we have to, in order to entrench this concept in our jurisdictions, the people have to own it. And the people can only own it if they understand the term that you are using to call this very important office.
Yes.
So in French-speaking countries, they refer to this office as the médiateur, but I am aware that they do translate it into local languages as well, places like Senegal, the Gabon, for people to understand. And at the same time, some countries, like for instance, those which have merged the mandates, like the Inspector General of Government in Uganda, they refer to the Ombudsman as the Inspector General of Government. In Angola, in Portuguese-speaking countries, they call it the Provedora de Justiça, meaning the provider of justice. But I must state at this point that the concept of the ombudsman seems to have some sort of different impacts in civil law countries and in common law countries. So in the civil law countries, they have they refer to judges as a judge investigator. Because judges in the civil law countries tend to go out and investigate, carry out interviews, collect the evidence, and then this is when they sit to actually hear the case. Whereas in common law jurisdictions, a judge is an independent arbiter who hears both parties. And after he has heard both parties, he comes to a conclusion. He is not a part of the collection of the evidence. So I think that even the Scandinavian countries had that sort of background. And when they were establishing the office of the ombudsman, they were establishing the office of a judge investigator. They gave this office the power of a judge investigator. So you find that even our colleagues in French-speaking countries accord their ombudspersons the status of a judge. I do recall that at one time in Zambia, we hosted a training for French and English-speaking countries, and we called our Chief Justice to as the guest of honor, and they were saying, no, but in our country, the ombudsman, the mediator is senior to the Chief Justice or on par. So this is from the civil law point of view. But when you come to the common law countries, this concept of the ombudsman being on the same status as a judge is not taken. As so, I think even for countries like the United Kingdom, they have to grapple with the same issues.
Thank you. Yes.
So just a small difference, just a bit of information about the office. There's so much confusion. And this is the reason why there has been a growing need. You have seen a growing body of international instruments, the Venice Principles, the IOR Tambo Declaration, the flurry of UN resolutions to try and see if they can find a middle ground to ensure that this office is properly established, standardized.
Okay, thank you. Now I'm laughing because I would have preferred you to tell the story in its original form. You don't be diplomatic. when you tell the story, you said when you invited the Chief Justice, one of your colleagues said, why did you invite your junior? Isn't that how it happened?
Well, if my recollection is correct.
Yes, thank you. But yeah, no, but this shows, on a more serious note, the point you are making that different jurisdictions have different models, but the general principle is the same, correct?
Yes.
And just a little bit of trivia, because we all don't want to be sexist, we all get into the habit of saying ombudsperson. But I was told some years ago that's actually wrong, because the man in ombudsman doesn't mean a man. It's ombudsman is actually a translation of Swedish, the Swedish language, which, as you correctly say, means the defender of rights or the people's protector. Correct?
Yes, yes, that is correct.
Yes. And therefore, we can be proud, I think, as South Africans and Zambians, that we probably have the closest translation of the original word ombudsman in people's protector or public protector, correct?
Yes, yes, yes.
And that paragraph that I wanted to show you, paragraph 12, just covers some of the information that you've given us, where you say, I'll just read it out for progress, Chair. They say, over time, several countries have established the ombudsman institutions in Africa, albeit under different names. In French-speaking countries in Africa, Francophone, the office of ombudsman is referred to as Médiateur de la République, which means a mediator of the Republic, whilst in Portuguese-speaking African countries, it is called Provedor de Justiça, which means the provider of justice. In Uganda, it's called Inspector General of government. In Kenya and Tanzania, the Office of Ombudsman is styled and named as a Commission for Administrative Justice. And you say, according to Professor Ayeni, one of the experts you referred to earlier, countries choose organizational names other than ombudsman to communicate the purpose of the organization and give the institution an identity that citizens of the countries concerned can associate with. So that captures the information you just gave us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. Now, going back to your affidavit and your credentials per se, you have also given an indication of a structure called IOC, African Ombudsman Research Center, with which you are associated, and I think all three of you public protectors and leaders in that space are associated with it. What is that institute? And I'm singling it out because it happens to be based here in South Africa, and you can also tell us how that came about.
Thank you so much. When the research center was moved from Dar es Salaam to South Africa, it was found necessary to establish a formal secretariat for the institution of the ombudsman. And as we were establishing this secretariat, it was felt that it should also be established in such a way that it can be sustainable. It can be a self-sustaining institution, secretariat. So it was thought that there was need, if it was going to be self-sustaining, it was going to be carrying out research, carrying out consultancies, then we needed to establish an institution which was sort of like separate, but still under the arm of AOMA. So it was then decided by the African, the executive of the African Ombudsman and Mediators Association to establish AOC as a research institute with corporate legal personality.
Mm-hmm.
So it was then established in 2011 as a research and training arm of AOMA. And it has a board, and this board is chaired by the Public Protector of South Africa. In a way, it mirrors the International Ombudsman Institution, except that the International Ombudsman Institution did not establish a separate research arm, but the chairperson of the of AOC is permanently the South African Public Protector, just as the permanent Secretary General of the International Ombudsman Institute in Vienna is the Chief Ombudsman of Austria. So the African Ombudsman and Research has entered into various memorandum of understandings with the different organizations. Chief among them is the cooperation which it has entered into with the International Ombudsman Institute. By entering into this cooperation with the International Ombudsman Institute, it has been hosting conferences for training the whole of Africa, African ombudsman staff and African ombudsmen themselves. And it has also, during the COVID era, I'm proud to say that AOC was the most active ombudsman center in the whole world. I think it was hosting webinars almost every month, and these were being attended by online by ombudsman institutions from each and every continent. Now, why the African Ombudsman Research Center is also very, very important is that with the Secretariat being registered here in South Africa, we were able to also harness cooperation with the South African government, and the South African government has been actually funding the African Ombudsman and Research Center. And if it was not for all the inputs and the sacrifice of the international of the South African government, the African Ombudsman and Research Center would not have been able to have such a big impact, not only on the African continent, but internationally as well.
Thank you. No, thank you very, very much. And I think the parallel with South Africa, the role that South Africa plays is the same as the role that Austria plays at the international level. Can you explain that briefly?
Yes. The Austrian government has accorded the International Ombudsman Institute support in that it pays for the staff who man the secretariat of the International Ombudsman Institute, and as well as that, it also has given a budget to the International Ombudsman Institute. So all the members of the International Ombudsman Institute pay subscriptions to the secretariat. And from those subscriptions, that money is used only for trainings and for regional activities to improve and encourage ombudsmanship in regions throughout the world. The International Ombudsman Institute has got 5 regions: Africa, North America, South America, Latin America, and the Australasia region as well. So without the support from the Austrian government, the International Ombudsman Institute would have found it very difficult actually to coordinate the international activities that it has. Pre-COVID, the International Ombudsman Institute was hosting about 2 or 3 trainings per year for ombudsman institutions. So AOC, as the secretariat of AOMA, is also playing a similar role for African ombudsman institutions.
Yes. And then takes me to something that, well, let's start with the O.R. Tambo Declaration. At paragraph 14 of your affidavit, you then refer to something called O.R. Tambo Declaration on the minimum standards for an effective ombudsman institution. What is that?
You will recall, I think, when I commenced my evidence that from 2005, when the African Ombudsman Association transformed to the African Ombudsman and Mediators Association, it was resolved that we needed to standardize the principles, ethics, of ombudsman institutions in Africa. It was very difficult. I'll speak even from a personal perspective. It was very difficult for me to explain to my government that I could not be accountable to the executive and investigate the executive. And we needed to move away from being an executive ombudsman to a parliamentary ombudsman. So we wanted to have standards, continental standards, which would assist ombudsman offices when they were having problems with their governments to be able to say these are their standards for the African continent. And this is what we need to do to improve the performance of the ombudsman institution in our country. So I'm very happy to say that I was part and parcel of the team that was actually drafting the O.R. Tambo minimum standards for an effective ombudsman institution. And they were launched in 2014, and by 2016 it helped me as well to lobby my own government when we were establishing the parliamentary ombudsman system. And by 2016 Zambia had transformed from an executive ombudsman institution to a parliamentary ombudsman system. And I hope that it has also helped a lot of other African countries in ensuring that they have a properly constituted ombudsman office in their jurisdictions.
Okay, thank you very much. And maybe again, just for the sake of progress, if you allow me, so that we don't have to come back to that topic, to just jump to that declaration, which is obviously important for the continent and South Africa, given its origin and even its name. Can we go to page, I think it's 266, Yes. Now, that's the O.R. Tambo Declaration on the Minimum Standards that you just explained to us, correct?
Yes, correct.
And if you can, just to confirm what you're saying, let's go right at the end. I will come back to 266. Let's go to 271, please, Tepa. The signatures. Yes. So just go further down a little bit. Or up, if that's down, then go up. Yeah, okay. Right. Yeah. And you think this document was adopted at O.R. Tambo International Airport, 26 February 2014, and it's signed by, I suppose, the then president of AOMA,
Yes, Dr. Paolo Cipilica.
Okay, and who's from where?
He was the Provedora de Justica for Angola.
From Angola, yes.
Yes.
And then it was signed by the Public Protector of South Africa, and then Advocate Tuli Madonsela, who is, I'm sure will tell us more about it. She's going to be one of our witnesses. Was that also to recognize the role that you say South Africa plays in this entire project?
At the time, the Public Protector of South Africa was both chairperson of the African Ombudsman Research Center, as well as executive secretary. At the time, the position of Secretary General was called Executive Secretary of the African Ombudsman and Mediators Association. So she signed in her capacity as Executive Secretary of AOMA.
Good. And all right, now let's go back to 266. Thank you. And against this, before I ask you specifically, when I was asking you earlier about the importance of these international institutions, the word that you used the most was the word protection. Why is that an important issue, the issue of the protection of incumbents or ombudsman offices?
As I explained earlier, the institution of the ombudsman is very unique in that it is a creature of political will. The government of the day has to allow for the institution to be created. Of course, public awareness, also increasingly public awareness and a call, just a general call from the people for an institution which supports the ordinary man has also helped. The wind of change of democracy has also helped to instate this institution in various countries. But once the institution is created, there are a lot of underlying problems in order for the ombudsman to be able to operate independently. So you can, if you look at all the instruments that I have quoted, not just the O.R. Tambo, the Venice Principles, the IOI bylaws, the United Nations resolutions, they all talk about the need to protect the independence of the ombudsman, because the ombudsman investigates the very office which created it and the very office which funds it and the very office which is supposed to pay the salary of all the salaries of the members of staff and the ombudsman himself. So you find, I think I can speak from experience, you find that the institution of the ombudsman will not be properly funded. It will probably be the least funded. And yet the institution is supposed to investigate the executive, whether it's parastatals, whether it's ministries, ministers, PSs, permanent secretaries. This ombudsman is supposed to investigate all these people. So the first thing you find that there is underfunding. The second issue, maybe you find that, which happened in my case, the ombudsman reports to the executive. And if the government does not accord the ombudsman the appropriate status, you will find that the ombudsman is in the civil service salary scale, and the head of the civil service is his boss. And when the officers from the ombudsman go to investigate the various officials, they are even threatened and told, how can you investigate your boss?
Mm.
You know? And you find that a lot of the members of staff in some instances are drawn from the civil service.
Mm.
So the members of staff start to fear that I will not be promoted, I'll be demoted, because they are within the structure of the civil service. So it became necessary to set up standards to say even the staff of the ombudsman must be appointed by the ombudsman and must be not drawn from the civil service. So other threats to the institution include also reprisals to the ombudsman himself, political reprisals to the ombudsman himself. So the conditions of service of the ombudsman may be tampered with. You may find that the ombudsman is not able to, even if he has the powers to access documents and other things, he may not be able to access documents, even if it's in the law, but it may not be possible. So you find that in a lot of jurisdictions, they say the ombudsman is a toothless dog, because they say that the ombudsman is supposed to be the public service watchdog. But the executive which establishes it is the one that is supposed to give it teeth. And by its very nature, and this is the reason why in the classical example, the ombudsman reports to the legislature in order to separate the issue of the ombudsman having a conflict of interest, being accountable to the very office it was established to investigate.
Yes. Thank you very much. Well, if we can just pause on that, and that I'll just ask you to maybe, insofar as you may, comment on this, because that issue that you have raised is features very prominently in this inquiry that we're having here in various ways. But let me just give you one example. And as I said, we are a young democracy. Maybe we can learn a thing or two, and maybe we can make the necessary adjustments. Learning also, and everyone has accepted here that this process is also for us to learn as a country. Now, in our situation, against the background that you have mapped, we have a strange situation where a member of the executive, for example, is given the power in terms of Section 194(3)(a) to suspend the public protector, basically in his or her own discretion, even in a situation where the public protector is investigating that person. Is that a good thing that is in line with the protections that you are talking about at a general level? An unfettered power to suspend at the hand of the executive. And if I will give you a comparative situation with judges, where that situation is quite different. But as far as the public protector is concerned, there isn't.
Just a pause, Alfred Mbof. Just a pause.
Okay. Without even finishing my sentence.
I'm sorry I interrupted you. Finish your sentence, Alfred Mbof.
No.
I've now recognized you.
Sorry. I thought that maybe in not wanting to get into an argument or debate with my colleague, that maybe it should be appropriately stated to the witness that it's not just a member of the executive, but it's the president.
Yes. Well, even worse, yes, that's correct. Even worse, the president, the most powerful member of the executive, thank you, has the power to suspend the ombudsman, and in our situation, in an act that one of our courts has labeled as retaliatory, because what had happened is that the public protector had issued certain questions to the president, and then she was suspended the following day. But that's the background. But the question I was putting to you is more general, without getting into the specifics of that case. I'm saying, in terms of the what you call the standards, the accepted standards, and the need for protection, which you have emphasized, would you say that situation where a member of the executive and the most important member or most powerful member of the executive has got that power without even, and I think it's in one of the countries, we'll come to that, without even having to get the confirmation of parliament, for example, is that a good thing?
I will state that according to ombudsman standards, we talk about the principles, applying the principles of natural justice, and we insist on procedural fairness in our work. And this insistence on applying the principles of natural justice and procedural fairness does not just extend to the ombudsman when the ombudsman is investigating. It extends to the relationships of the ombudsman and his members of staff. Whatever he does, he must be guided by the principles of natural justice. Those are our tools, our working tools, and by the concept of procedural fairness at all times. And even in our administrative interactions with, whether it is the executive, whether with it is with the judiciary, or whether it is with the legislature, that is the standard that we use. And if that is the standard that we use, then I expect that the different arms of government will recognize that, and they will also insist on adhering to the same high standards of procedural fairness. But of course, it's a work in progress. In all jurisdictions, it's a work in progress.
Yes, thank you. All right, maybe let me put it this way. The, again, if we try to keep it at the general level, let's assume we have three countries. Let's call it country A, country B, and country C. In country A, before the public protector can be suspended, there is a system where you have to get confirmation from parliament. And as I say, I know it's one of the countries, I'll give you that example. Okay, so that's country A. In country B, there has to be, or rather, even the suspension itself is done by an independent body of judges or whatever, independent body. And in country C, the president can just suspend you without those two protections. Is which, according to the things that you are telling us, which of those is the worst system?
Of course, the third one is
yes.
The worst system. But I must state that because we are talking about the institution of the ombudsman, it is absolutely necessary when any of the arms of government is dealing with any issue regarding the ombudsman, that procedural fairness must apply, because the ombudsman is in a very vulnerable position. As I said before, the ombudsman investigates the executive.
Yes.
So it's absolutely necessary to accord the ombudsman the highest levels of procedural fairness available. It's one person operating in an office as a legal entity, and the responsibility of making final decisions for all the investigations in the institution lies upon the shoulder of that officer. It's not easy. It's very, very stressful, speaking from experience. So the ombudsman must be accorded the highest level of how should I put it? Administrative and legal support to ensure that there is procedural fairness when any issue to deal with the institution is under the purview of any of the arms of government. So you said in the first instance where there is a suspension, which is subject to a process and another process. So I would suppose that first that process must be completed before any decision can be made to accord any sort of decision with regard to that office holder. And in the second instance where the body is completely independent, I assume that all the proper procedures are in place, and the office holder would not have any complaint really with the process. And then with this country, you see where the president just suspends arbitrarily. Obviously, there isn't a proper ombudsman system in place.
Yeah.
You can't even really categorize it as there being an ombudsman in that country if there is such a situation.
Yeah.
And I will say that we have had applications like at the International Ombudsman Institute from countries where the ombudsman is appointed and dismissed by the executive.
Oh.
And normally, according to our criteria, we don't accept membership of such countries.
Okay. Thank you. You've taken me to my next question. So, again, we're talking about some country somewhere in the air. If it was to be found in that country that something like what you and I have described, which doesn't really accord with how the institution of ombudsman should be run, am I understanding you to say that that country might face the possibility of being expelled? Maybe that's a strong word, but at least not being accepted into the family of ombudsman institutions in the world. Let's say let's use your country. If that in Zambia, tomorrow they come up with measures which clearly are not in accordance with the minimum standards, would that risk expulsion from IOI and that kind of thing?
Such decisions are not taken very liberally. There's usually a lot of toing and froing.
I assume the toing and froing is done. So then what would be the worst thing that could happen?
Yes,
such
the
a
worst that can happen is expulsion.
Okay. Thank you. Now, you talked about reprisals.
Yes.
As one of the, and we're still on the subject of protection. Yeah. Looks like one of your themes is that there must be these instruments, if you summarize them, all call for maximum protection of ombudsman incumbents and offices for the reasons that you've explained, because the office is inherently vulnerable and it investigates very, very powerful people.
Yes.
Now, and institutions, yeah. This is what I want to get at, and I'm just cutting to the chase so that I can be sure that my country is not going to be expelled. We have the following situation here, and if you go to, oh no, let me start by saying this, which is more important. Is it correct that in your explanation of the separation of powers, earlier, you said that Parliament, and again, we're talking in general terms, should actually be protecting the public protector?
Let me start by saying that, of course, there are different systems mm-hmm. The world over. Mm. But if we're talking about the classical
uh-huh.
model, the ombudsman is accountable to Parliament,
uh-huh.
is appointed by Parliament,
uh-huh.
and can be dismissed from office by Parliament in the classical model.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Now, I think it was not envisaged that a situation would arise where an ombudsman really needs to be disciplined unless they've really grossly misconducted themselves, because the way the classical model is designed, the ombudsman has the unfettered powers of a judge mm. during the course of investigations. So in order for you to be able to get the information, to get the evidence, you have to use those powers
mm.
until the point where you are issuing the reports. Then those powers drop from you. You issue a report where you only make recommendations.
Oh.
And the reason why that is so was to prevent the ombudsman from always being in continuous litigation if they were made to have binding powers. And also, the second reason is just to ensure that there can be no acts of retribution
uh-huh.
from the executive, no harassment, because then the recommendations are just so. They are recommendations. If the executive wants, they can ignore those recommendations. And then the ombudsman now has the added protection of going to Parliament to say, I issued this report, and the respondent is not willing to implement the recommendations. And then it would then have to be up to Parliament to send this matter to a committee, which would then engage the respondent institution. to ensure compliance. So in a classical model, it was never envisaged that the reports of the ombudsman would have to go to as far as the courts, really. Yes.
All right. Maybe let me ask it differently. Of the three arms of government, who should protect the public protector?
The reason why we say the office of the ombudsman should be accountable to parliament is because through the system of checks and balances of the separation of powers,
mm-hmm.
you want to ensure that the ombudsman reports to a body which it does not investigate. That is the protection that is accorded to the ombudsman.
So which of the three should protect the public?
The legislature.
Thank you. And if you put it crudely, the legislature should protect the public protector from who? Who is, or maybe let me ask it differently. Which of the three arms is most likely to pose a threat to the public protector?
Because the ombudsman investigates the executive, so the executive is the branch that is most likely to erect these barriers to the work of the ombudsman to ensure that the ombudsman does not work effectively. But I must state here again that the judiciary also offers a protection in that it gives the office of the ombudsman the powers to make all the orders of a which are equivalent to a high court during the course of investigations. So these two protections work very well. And then that at the end of the day, the report doesn't lay hidden in somebody's desk. It has to go to the legislature to ensure that it is it gets compliance from the executive.
Yes. Thank you. So if we then summarize it, you're saying the executive is most likely to pose a threat, correct?
Yes.
And the primary protection should come from the legislature.
Yes.
But also the judiciary should also play a part in the protection.
Because it gives the powers.
Yes.
It gives the powers to the ombudsman.
Yes. Now, what happens in this case? Okay, our favorite country somewhere in some continent. What happens in a situation where now you have a situation where the legislature that is supposed to be the protector of the public protector and the judiciary that's also supposed to be the protector? Or let me put it this way. The legislature actually takes judgments from the judiciary and says, these are binding. We're just going to plonk them. Sorry, that's probably Africans. we're just going to transplant them. And you're gone. In other words, the two arms that are supposed to protect you, then wittingly or unwittingly collaborate to the one just borrows from the other, some ready-made product, and is the conduit pipe, and then you must be removed. Is that country complying with what should be happening?
The legislature, uh-huh. in this case, in the way that the classical ombudsman operates, The legislature is supposed to only come in to scrutinize the ombudsman in an instance, as I said, where there is, you know, gross misconduct. But in the constitutional performance of the office of the ombudsman, I think the aspect of upholding the constitution comes in my view, because the office of the ombudsman is accountable to parliament and lays its reports before parliament. And it is at that point that they can comment and say to the ombudsman, we do not agree with this report, because they can refuse to implement the report. They can refuse to implement the report. But for when the, I assume like even in my jurisdiction, I'll give an example of my jurisdiction. When a matter comes before my office and I issue a report, it is a binding, I do not issue recommendations, it's a binding report. But when it goes to the courts of law, because now it's binding, I don't even need the legislature to enforce that matter. So when the respondent appeals, if I make a finding against the respondent can go to a court of law. And when it goes to the court of law, if it goes against me, I don't think that, because that is it's the normal process. You are trying to exhaust the administrative channels of appeal. The respondent is trying to exhaust the administrative channels of appeal. And I don't see the reason why that judgment should go back to the legislature.
Yes. Okay.
The respondent is allowed, it is his right to exhaust the channels of appeal, to go through the court process and go through the channels of appeal.
Yes, okay, let me ask it more directly. Is a country that allows a system where a product from the one arm of the state, the judiciary, is simply transplanted into parliament and used to remove an ombudsman, a good system?
I would say that the checks and balances then are not working properly, because if a matter goes to court and a judgment is made, what is the reason to reinforce it again? I don't know. Maybe I don't understand the question. But as far as I can see, the normal checks and balances of the three arms of government should not cross over unless, I don't know. I'm not privy to maybe the legislation,
okay.
And the...
All right. Let me stop talking about some country somewhere else. Okay. Here, in this inquiry, and I may be wrong about the numbers, 90% of the charges are directly based on court judgments, which are brought here. And we were told on the first day when we got here that those court judgments are binding. And so I don't even know why we're here, because if they're binding, then I suppose we should have just wielded the X on day one here. But that's a separate issue. I'm saying that, is it a good thing that a public protector, an ombudsman, can be removed on the basis of 90% of the material or more. That might even be underestimated. That comes directly from the judiciary into an inquiry, and then it's just tick box. Okay, the judge said you did this wrongly, therefore you did it wrongly. The judge said you did not give this one a hearing, therefore you didn't give them a hearing. The judge said you were biased, therefore you're biased. Off you go, chop the head. Is that what was envisaged in the instruments that you've described?
The ombudsman, by the very nature of their work, the fact that they investigate the executive, when a matter goes to court and the matter goes against the ombudsman, I think it is the system is cleansing itself well, because the reports of the ombudsman are being put up to scrutiny by the courts of law. And the courts of law are able to say, no, here, ombudsman, you were wrong. And it is also a way of ensuring excellence in the work of the ombudsman. So there is no reason why, when the courts do their job, they've done their job. They've said, ombudsman, here you were wrong, or ombudsman, here you were right. They've done their job. The system has cleansed itself. I don't know. I don't see the reason why it should be taken up by another arm of government again. I don't know. That is my view. That is my professional view. That there is no need for... The system has cleansed itself. And if that ombudsman is an ombudsman who is aware of the principles and ethics of their job, they will take note of what the courts are saying. Good. And implement it in their work to ensure that it doesn't happen again.
Yes, good. Okay.
Maybe Advocate Murphy, if we can pause. Unless you want to throw small questions.
Give me one question just to wrap up that point so that we don't forget it. Yes, okay, let me go back to my old system. You have two countries. In one country, what you have just described happens. The judges make their judgment, and as you correctly say, it should be a learning tool for any public protector. Once a judgment says this and so on, and assume it has gone all the way up to the highest court, so it can be changed. So it now becomes a learning document. So that's what happens in one country, and it ends there. In the other country, it doesn't end there. That judgment is taken and used by the legislature now to now do more than what the courts have done, to actually remove the person. Which of those two systems is better? The one where it's used as a learning, it goes its full course and it's a learning process. And as you say, hopefully it doesn't happen again. Or the one where it's taken as a weapon of mass destruction?
I think I'll just state that this is the reason why the international ombudsman world has insisted on ombudsman standards.
Mm-hmm.
If we are to apply the standards when we are setting up, from the time we are setting up ombudsman institutions, if we say, okay, it's a pity that the standards have come way after ombudsman institutions have been established, but still there is a way of correcting our constitutions, there is a way of correcting our legislations. If we adhere to the standards, then such a situation should not arise.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Okay, have a break. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Advocate Mpofu and Advocate Sokoni. We'll pause for 15 minutes break and be back at 1:45. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Recording stopped.
Your attention. We resume. Ms. Sokoni, are you settled? Are you comfortable? Thank you. Welcome back, colleagues. Over to you, Advocate Mpofu.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning again, Honorable. Okay, I'm just greeting you so that I can see if the tone. Can you either get closer to the mic or speak more loudly? All right. We were dealing with this thing, and it's in my view, a very important part of this context that we're trying to paint here. Now, I'm going back to this issue of the judgments versus the inquiry, removal inquiry.
Sorry, I took it off. Can you tell me where in your statement we're at the moment?
Oh, okay. In where it deals with the separation of powers. Hold on. Okay, well, this issue of suppression of powers is everywhere. You talk about, okay, for example, paragraph 7. Remember, we're still talking about your favorite word, which is the protection. Okay, I'll just read it out. It's long, but since I've been asked to, I'll do it. You say that at paragraph 7, it's of the statement, which is, my page is in
the same page. Oh, sorry, with a different page number.
I'm looking for the big number. The type is
216.
Starts at 216. Paragraph 7. Yeah, everything is important. Okay, that's 219. Okay, good. We're there. All right. It's long, as I said, but it says, concerning an ombudsman's mandate, the Venice principles include, and we'll go to this Venice principles in more detail. I'm sure I was just dealing with the protection thing. Include the prevention and correction of maladministration and the protection and promotion of human rights and fundamental freedom. The Venice principles stress that the protection and promotion of human rights and fundamental freedoms should also be extended to the ombudsman and deputies and their staff. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So let's pause there. Am I correct that there, the word protection, which is used twice, is used in two different contexts? One is the protection of the public. That's why it's called the public protector. But you are saying that the principle talk about the protection of the public protector herself or himself, correct?
Yes.
Which is what we're busy with here. So that's the first issue. And then Then they stress on the aspect of immunity of the ombudsman and the staff from court action with regard to the implementation of the core function of the institution. That's the judiciary, the thing that you and I have been discussing.
Yes, yes, that's
okay.
Correct.
Right. And then say the Venice Principles refer to this as functional immunity. This is a big one we will be discussing later, functional immunity. So you can park that. States are further urged to refrain from taking any action aiming at or resulting in the suppression of the ombudsman institution. That's what I was leading you on now. States, including South Africa, have, as a matter of practice, included the immunity from court action of the ombudsman and their staff. Right? Then you say the rationale for including this clause is meant to discourage governments from using more than one branch of government from exercising administrative or disciplinary control over the office of over the ombudsman. Disciplinary control would include an inquiry such as the one we're having here, correct?
Yeah, correct.
So yeah, the ombudsman rides on drawing authority from the three arms of government in order to carry out its functions, your evidence about separation of powers, right? However, all three arms of government cannot exercise administrative authority over the office of the ombudsman. It is because the executive is so powerful, the point you made earlier, that checks and balances of the separation of powers become necessary. The very nature of its work demands that the executive be reined in by the judiciary through the judicial review of administrative power and by the legislature, which carries a watching brief of executive, should probably be over executive actions and decisions by subjecting the actions and decisions to review through parliamentary debates and approval or disapproval in the implementation of pertinent government policies tabled in the form of bills before the House. However, the Ombudsman is normally established as a corporate soul, a single person, set up a legal entity with no powers which can be equated to the executive. And here's the punchline. The office of the Ombudsman was not intended to be the object of disciplinary or administrative censure by all three branches of government at the same time. This weakens the independence of the office. Is that what we're discussing now? The issue of if she or he is in a way the object of disciplinary censure by all the three arms. We've spoken about the powers of the executive to suspend. I'm now busy with the what I call the collaboration, for lack of a better word, between the judiciary and the legislature for a process such as this one. Are we together?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. So that's the answer to my learned colleague. Yeah. Okay, let's come back then to the subject. Maybe thanks to her, we should then use this paragraph as the basis of how we take this further. Yeah. Now, I'm saying then, if you have a situation then where the executive, in this context, we know the bad guys, they're likely to be. The ones who attempted to threaten the public protector with reprisals. I think we've established that. I'm now looking at the other two arms. I'm saying if we have a situation where the two arms are in a way just passing the same judgment that came from one of the arms called the judiciary, is now being used by the legislature. So in a way, you have all the three arms, as it were, ganging up, for lack of a better word, against just this one institution. Who then must protect the public protector?
The Office of the Ombudsman, as I stated, is established as a corporate soul, and the office is accountable to Parliament. So any issues which arise in the office should be tabled before Parliament. Any sort of whether it's administrative, whether it's a legal matter which they are facing, should the public protector or the ombudsman should feel free to go to the legislature and seek counsel, you know, for that particular matter, or seek protection for that particular matter. Now, with respect to the judiciary also offers protection to the ombudsman in that when the reports are tabled before the judiciary, the judiciary gives that extra scrutiny, that independent scrutiny also on the reports of the ombudsman. So these protections can operate and should operate independently of each other. However, when one arm of government takes a decision, perhaps that is not advantageous to the ombudsman, I don't know, because I have not seen this happen before. I don't know how it crosses over. So one is administrative, one is an administrative disciplinary procedure. Then, but it's emanating from a finding of the judiciary. I think it is not supposed to be so, because when the judiciary makes a finding over a report, that is the normal procedure. Like I said, that is the normal cleansing system.
All right.
The system is cleansing itself out. And the public protector, like I said, I repeat again, the public protector or the ombudsman learns a thing or two and changes the procedures, the processes within the office to adhere to the judgment.
Yeah.
And I think that is what happened, for example, in the Zambian situation. It was a matter which went against us, where the respondent took us to court. And we changed our processes and procedures accordingly, because the Constitutional Court also gave a ruling in that matter. And we accordingly applied their guidance.
Yeah.
Okay. So I would not expect that matter would cross over again to the legislature.
Yeah, well, it happens here in South Africa. All right. And let me just be clear that when I say maybe so that your evidence is not misunderstood, I'm talking about, shall we call it, institutional and structural independence and protection mechanisms. When I say the legislature and the judiciary, I don't mean like one day in some dark room you have the Chief Justice and the President and the Speaker of Parliament saying, oh, let's go and get the public protector. I'm talking about institutionally entrenched independence and the dangers of the absence thereof. So that's why I was asking you whether a system that allows for a product of one of the arms being the judiciary to simply be used by the other is a good one or a bad one. But that's fine. Let's take it further, because I think you have given the answer. Now, what I'm coming at is this. Really, let's just cut to the chase here. Again, I want to give to my so-called exemplary country. In this country here, in this room, actually, when the issue of for example, the suspension, the unlawful suspension of the public protector is raised or was raised to the people that you say should be protecting her, the answer is that that has nothing to do with us. That's the stance of the South African Parliament. That the issue of the suspension, lawful or unlawful, retaliatory or not, inspired by 31 questions or not, has got nothing to do with us. Pontius Pilate approach. So the South African Parliament has washed its hands in biblical terms from such a thing, such an intervention by the executive. Is that how the system is supposed to work?
You have said in your previous question that I think 90% of the charges are emanating from court judgments.
Yes.
So if that is the case, the precedent has already been set. And if there is another court judgment that comes out and that favors the office of the ombudsman, then it's taking into account procedural fairness, then that judgment must also be taken into account by the body that is looking into the matter. I think it's just... that's fair. It's only fair that if some judgments have been tabled before a body that is hearing a matter, and those are adverse to the person, and then some other judgments that are in the favor of that person come out, and those are not accorded the same and equal attention by that body that is hearing the matter, then there's been some unfairness, and this involves the issue of a person's rights.
Yes. Thank you. So then your answer to my question, which is whether it is correct, fair, in accordance with the principles that you have enunciated here, for a parliament of a country to say the matter of the fairness or unfairness or legality or illegality of a suspension of the public protector has got nothing to do with us. Is that consistent with those principles?
No,
if that
doesn't
is the,
seem to be
sorry.
Consistent. As I have said, if they are taking into account consideration of certain judgments which have come out, which are disadvantageous to the person who is appearing before them. And then they take those into account. Then there are other judgments which come out which are advantageous to that person. And then they say that they cannot take those into account as well.
Yeah.
Then the issue now of fairness comes in, because the rights of that person have not been respected.
Yes. Okay. That's probably the worst case scenario. Let's even be kinder. Let's assume this is another country. There's no situation where they've taken into account the judgments that are not favorable and what have you. We're just starting from scratch. And you come to that country, you say, Parliament, my protectors, please, I have been illegally suspended. And the Parliament of that country says, this has nothing to do with us. Forget the comparison. So is that on its own a good thing? Like going to a police station and the police say, you say, someone has just stabbed me, and they say, well, it's got nothing to do with us. The body that's supposed to protect you, if it says, an illegality that has happened to you has got nothing to do with them. Is that in accordance with the principles?
I think before a person has been suspended, they must be made aware of the charges that are against them, and they must be given a fair hearing. So this is a body of ultimate justice, you know, and fair play, and as a legislature, and they should be able to assist an officer who is accountable to them to say, well, what are the charges before you? Has fair play been taken into account in this particular instance? And they should accord the appropriate protections. If they are available, they should accord those protections.
Let me, then I'll go to page 414, please.
Where do you want to go?
414. Oh, I thought they're all on item H. Are we not on item H today? Okay. So I'm just giving you the page numbers like I've done before.
Advocate Mpofu, these different items that your team's put into bundle H.
That's the one.
And they're not marked 414. So we have difficult...
But the page numbers are continuous.
So
anyway,
the page number you...
We found it. Yeah. Thank you very much. Let's go to paragraph 157. Let's go down. Yeah. I'll read out. This is what our court has said in this situation that this parliament says has got nothing to do with them. It says, in our view, this is a full court, the hurried nature of the suspension of the applicant in the circumstances, notwithstanding that a judgment of the full court was looming on the same subject matter, leads this court to an ineluctable conclusion that the suspension may have been retaliatory, that's the reprisals you're talking about, and hence unlawful. It was certainly tainted by bias of a disqualifying kind and perhaps improper motive. In our view, the president could not bring an unbiased mind to bear as he was conflicted when he suspended the applicant. I'm saying that situation, if it happens in any country, can the legislature of that country say, we hear this, but it has nothing to do with us? Is that a good thing? Or rather, maybe let's not use good or bad. Would that situation, the behavior of that parliament, be consistent with the principles that you have enunciated from the UN, the IOI, IOMA, ARTAMO principles and what have you, all the protections you have spoken about? Would an attitude of a legislature that says this about its ombudsman, when a court has said this, be consistent with those principles?
It would not be consistent with those principles because this is a person's rights that we are talking about. And that person is a citizen of that country and entitled to enjoy the rights that can be availed to there by the body that is carrying out the investigation. So,
okay.
No.
Thank you very much. All right. So, and well, let's not even go to that parliament of that country refusing or saying that that person who's accused of all those things there is not a relevant witness to be called. I think the answer to that follows from your previous answer, but that's a debate for another day. All right. Now, let's go back to our, I'm just wanting to check if my country is not going to be expelled. All right, so far we've found big areas where the first one was the ability of a member of the executive who's being investigated in our case on six different investigations to suspend the person investigating them without having to check with Parliament or anything like that. And the second one was this issue of the Parliament that says, mea culpa, we're not going to get involved in whatever abuse has been found by the court. All right. Now, if you go to the O.R. Tambo Declaration, and I'll take you just quickly to the minimum standards on page 268, thank you. 268. The two words that seem to permeate all these instruments are captured at 1.1. The independence and autonomy of these institutions must be guaranteed by the Constitution. Agree?
Yes.
Okay. Now, independence, I think you've spoken a lot about. We'll come back to it in a different context. I want to now talk about autonomy. Just again to see if the South African situation conforms with the international instruments. By the way, South Africa is a signatory or a member of the UNGA, United Nations General Assembly instruments, which we'll come into. And so is your country, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. And as we've seen, it's a signatory to this document, and it even houses the institute, AWOC, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Right. Now, what is this autonomy that appears in all these documents, whether it's the Venice Principles, the Paris Principles, the O.R. Tambo, the UN General Assembly? Why is this important? And I said we'll come back to the issue of functional autonomy. Firstly, what is that? And why is it important?
The Venice Principles refer to functional autonomy of the ombudsman, meaning that the ombudsman must not be brought up for charges concerning his constitutional, legislative, or administrative functions. And the reason why this is recognized as a need to extend the protection to the ombudsman in that for the administrative functions of the ombudsman, if, for example, the members of staff are employed by the executive directly, it is likely that they can be compromised. Or for example, some of the standards go as far as saying the ombudsman must not be housed in a government building with other government institutions, because it means that if there are complainants coming from those government departments, they'll be apprehensive to come and lodge a complaint. So when we talk about administrative autonomy, we talk about the staffing, the administrative support to the institution, as much as possible, this should be independent from the executive. Then when we talk about the legislative autonomy, we're talking about the setup within the constitution and the enabling statute, which has provisions which talk about the independence of the institution, that the office holder shall not be accountable to any other office, and nor answerable to any other office, and also that in the investigations that are carried out by that particular office, there shall not be any interference by any arm government from any person. So this is what the Venice Principles refer to as the functional autonomy, and they even go further to say that the office holder must have immunity from any form of civil or criminal litigation regarding the administration of the mandate of that office. And this is, like I said, this is a recurring theme in all the instruments that with regard to the Office of the Ombudsman.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much. All right, we'll go to the Venice Principles themselves. For now, I'm just testing against, let's say, charity begins at home. So I'm just testing it against the OR Tambo principles. All right, so let's go now to our favorite country, which, as by now it must be clear, is South Africa.
was that the country in the air?
Yes, it has come back to earth. Thank you. Now, in terms of functional autonomy, again, I'll describe your situation, true story, and you'll tell me if it is consistent with functional autonomy. We have an impeachment process, an inquiry, parliamentary inquiry at that. Okay, this is the high level, highest accountability mechanism. In that inquiry, you have 18 witnesses that are called. 15 of those are employees, including disgruntled employees who have this and that gripe and were given this letter or that letter and what have you, or disciplined for sexual harassment and everything like that. Is it consistent with functional autonomy and immunity that Parliament should busy itself with those kinds of internal workings? This one came late to work and this one was disciplined. Maybe they should not have been disciplined and what have you. Is that consistent with the principle of the sacrosanct principle of functional autonomy? Let's exaggerate. Let's say there were 15 witnesses and all of them were about that.
I would say it is not consistent with the principle of functional autonomy, because the institution of the Ombudsman, by its very nature, as I said before, is a creature of the executive. And I don't know how the system is here in South Africa. But most, like for my staff in my office, all of them are civil servants. So if they were all to testify against me, it would really be going flying against the all the principles in the book regarding the functional autonomy of the ombudsman. And that is why I think all the principles, all the international instruments insist that the members of staff of the ombudsman should be employed directly by the ombudsman.
Yes. And in line with what you and I will know as the principle of reciprocity in matters of that kind, in layman's language, the public protector should therefore have the right to hire and fire autonomously.
Correct? Yes, according to the standards, the ombudsman should have that right in order to prevent these issues of conflict of interest arising, even from among the members of staff.
Yes. And then would a parliament, a reasonable parliament, if there's such a thing, busy itself then with, no, this one, there was an interview, and then number three should have been number two, and this one was hired instead of that one, or vice versa. There was a disciplinary process, and this one got an Audi letter, this one didn't get it, that kind of thing, which has to do with hiring and firing. If a parliament busied itself mainly, 90% of its business was around those issues, would that be consistent with functional independence and autonomy and immunity?
Speaking from, like I said, from my own jurisdiction, first of all of them are civil servants, so I would take it that any tribunal that is calling them up would first try to establish the relative independence of these particular witnesses.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and then secondly, I would say that each of these people, if they have a grudge against the office of the ombudsman, they have the right to go to any court of law or any tribunal to bring up their cases and complain. I don't see the reason why it would have to go through the one institution which the office of the ombudsman is accountable to. Seems a bit, I don't know, odd anyway.
Well, that's an understatement, but we can understand you should be diplomatic as our visitor. But I think when we do the wrapping up, we'll find other adjectives than odd. But yeah, be that as it may, you were fortunate or unfortunate to be here for the evidence of Mr. Samuel, for example. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. I'm saying if you had people who, it turns out, sometimes by their own admission, those who were honest enough, that they had a gripe. And as you say, let's assume the gripe is legitimate for some reason or another. Let's say maybe their disciplinary process was rushed or whatever. But they have a gripe at the human resources level, such as Mr. Samuel, whose evidence you listen to. The point I'm making is that for that to be entertained, and as you've said, it could be entertained in the labor court or whatever, we have such a thing in this country.
But for those people who have those gripes, is the platform of a disciplinary or a removal process of an independent function by a parliament the platform to entertain those kinds of things? I'm not saying they should be suppressed. I think you've said they've got other avenues, but should they be expressed in the context of a removal process vis-a-vis functional autonomy?
You see, these matters of hiring and firing and disciplining, they are going on almost every day in almost all institutions. So I think Parliament's time would actually, they would be overwhelmed with such matters if indeed all the institutions that are accountable to Parliament, if they were to go through a similar process, they would actually, that's my view anyway, I think to put it simply, it would really be an overwhelming process for them if that is the way that we have to go, because in each and every institution, there are issues of staff turnover, if I can put it that way.
Uh-huh.
So if we really were to go into each and every institution, we would actually find that there are people who have issues with their supervising officers,
uh-huh,
or heads of institutions. So that is the reason why I'm saying that if a matter has to come regarding the public protector, has to come before any body or any tribunal, it should be a matter where there is really gross misconduct on the part of the ombudsman, not just the day-to-day running of the office and the day-to-day disciplining of officers. I recall, in my office, there was a time when there was a non-implementation of decisions by the CEO, and this person was coming from the government,
mm-hmm,
and I did explain to the government that there is non-implementations of the decisions of both the head of finance, the secretary of the treasury, and the secretary of the cabinet, and myself by this officer, and I surrendered that officer back to government. I don't know if that would...
Yeah, well...
I'm just trying to give an example that these things happen.
Yeah.
They happen all the time.
No, that's a good example. As I say again, you are diplomatic. When you say you surrendered the person back to government, you mean you fired them. You got rid of them from your office.
From the institution.
Yeah. All right. Thanks. All right. No, fair enough. And you were not impeached? You're still
no,
here?
No.
Yeah. All right. Now, again, let me just get zero in. You know, I say that we are a young democracy, and maybe we'll hopefully learn something from this process. We've been talking about the duty to protect, and you use that word repeatedly this morning. So let me take it closer to home. The drafters of our constitution were wise enough to think that a day like this might come, and the elevated status of the legislature in particular is now one of the organs, not just the organs of government, but also as an organ of state. The obligations actually to protect the public protector.
were codified as follows. In section 181, 3 and 4, but let me start with 181, 3. Then I'll ask you to comment on the examples that I'm giving. 183 says these institutions, and that includes, let's say, the public protector, are independent. I'm reading from 181.2 of the Constitution, of our Constitution. These institutions are independent and subject only to the Constitution and the law. And they must, underline must here, be impartial and must exercise their powers and perform their functions without fear, favor, or prejudice. Starting there, okay? We've dealt with the issue of fear. The fear, we know where it mainly would come from, okay? Now go to the subsection 3. Other organs of state, in other words, other fellow organs of state in general, but well, I'm talking now specifically about parliament, which is, has an elevated status. Through legislative and other measures must assist and protect these institutions to ensure the independence, impartiality, dignity, and effectiveness of these institutions. So read it now specifically to our context. The parliament and other organs of state, through legislation and other means, must assist and protect the public protector to ensure her independence, impartial dignity, and effectiveness. Okay. And then the last one, the next one, which captures probably the sentiment you've just spoken about functional autonomy even better. No person or organ of state may interfere with the functioning of these institutions. Would you agree that that sentiment captures what you and I have been calling functional autonomy?
Yes, I would agree. I would actually even further state that as democratic states and also having a system where we lay precedence, we must always examine the processes and procedures that we implement regarding the protection of human rights, because the precedents that we are setting in the hands of, let's say, a nation that does not have adhered to proper democratic principles, mm-hmm. they can misuse these sorts of precedents to intimidate and harass and victimize an ombudsman, because they will say, well, it has been done before, so we can do it again. They can replicate it. So, yeah, we have to be very, very careful when we are dealing with the implementation of human rights issues. We really, really have to be so careful.
Yes, I agree. But specifically talking about the institution of ombudsman, I'm saying that our discussion so far, with the examples that I've given you, let's start with the duty to protect. I think we dealt with that in the morning, and I've given you examples which you have agreed are inconsistent with the protection of the independence of the institutions. But now we're talking specifically about functional autonomy.
Yes.
And I'm saying to you that, the word is there. Okay, maybe let me do it like this. Why do you think our founding mothers and fathers of our constitution found it necessary to include that subsection 4, which you and I have agreed deals with functional economy. No person or organ of state may interfere with the functioning of these institutions. And you've said that includes the HR hiring and firing issues. Why? What's the importance of that in the context of the ombudsman principles that you have described?
I think let me put it like this. The functions of the Office of the Ombudsman depend so much on its independence.
Uh-huh.
There is no way that the Office of the Ombudsman can function without administrative and legislative autonomy. That is a core principle.
Uh-huh.
It can't.
Yeah. And if it is undermined, if there is a process that undermines that, is that in accordance with or in conflict with the accepted principles of this office, including 1.1 of the OR Tambo declaration?
Yes, it obviously breaches all the international instruments because they all talk about this functional autonomy, and it doesn't make the next incumbent of the office feels any safer, I think, to have a process like this going on.
Yeah. That's okay. No, all right. In other words, if a public protector or a judge, and I'll come to that, was to be impeached in breach of the principle of functional autonomy, the next one will know that you can't fire anyone, you can't give anyone deadlines, you can't do performance management, because one day these people might go to parliament and you'll be impeached. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, you make the ombudsman literally a slave of the system.
Hmm.
Yeah, because there'll be so frightened of their own shadow.
Yes. Well, it's more than looking over your shoulder to, or chasing your shadow. I think it's a clear warning that you must refrain from doing so. Isn't it that when we do disciplinary measures, we are teaching a lesson even to those who might follow?
This is the reason why I talked about the issue of precedent.
Hmm.
But maybe I must state that these things are real. This is the reason why these issues have been put in these documents.
Uh-huh.
I also went through a similar process in my early years when I was appointed as ombudsman, when every single process that was going on in the office was under the telescope of law enforcement institutions. So it really disturbed the functioning of the office, and as I said, it strengthened my resolve to have the office be transformed to a legislative ombudsman. This was being done by the executive at the time. Yes.
Thank you. And one has to assume, and I'm sure you know this, I'll ask it as a leading question, that when your country, Zambia, migrated from the executive ombuds system to the current parliamentary system in 2016, these were some of the issues that were being thrown away into the dustbin of history to move forward.
Yes, yes.
And
we're still even going through the process of implementing the administrative autonomy.
Yes. Now, in that context, therefore, a country that then goes to that dustbin and fetches the system where administrative and functional autonomy is subjected to parliamentary scrutiny. Is that a movement forward or a movement backward?
For the functional autonomy especially, I think it's a movement backwards.
Thanks. All right. And by the way, let me just say this. Okay. So sorry, I don't want to lose this point, but just to link up something to do with your credentials, which is relevant to this. We all accept that one of the most well-known protections for these kinds of offices is something called security of tenure, correct?
Yes, yes.
And you've spoken about immunity, we'll come back to that. But the security of tenure, I'm asking you out of interest because in one of the instruments, and we'll go to them, it says that the term of office should be basically as, well, firstly, it must be longer than the term of office of the parliamentarians. And it must be possibly as long and secure as possible. I think in your country, you say next year you'll be in the office for 20 years.
Yes.
And in Zambia, you can hold the office until you are 60.
Yes, until the age of 60.
Yes. So if you are employed at age of 20, you can hold it for 40 years.
Yes.
Theoretically.
Yes, yes.
Thanks. All right. Now, and that's part of the protective mechanisms from this kind of thing, from interference by all sorts of people who are conflicted, correct?
Yes, but it's not the prescribed model.
Mm-hmm.
The prescribed model is that the tenure of the ombudsman should be for a prescribed time, maybe 2 terms or 5 years, or like here in South Africa, 1 term of 7 years. And this is to ensure that the term of office is certain and it should not be interfered with. It's usually prescribed by the constitution. And one of the reasons why there is security of tenure for the office is to prevent the unlawful or unwanted removal of an office holder from office before they have finished their term of office due to other reasons which may not be known to other parties.
Yes. Thank you. Okay. And no, the point I was really driving at is that the general trend is to lengthen the period.
Yes.
And we in South Africa are probably at the barest minimum, because according to the Venice Principles, the minimum period should be 7 years. But obviously, the word minimum means it should preferably be more, but not less than 7 years.
Yes.
And Chair, I'm just digressing to get rid of this. I'm still going to go back to what I was busy with. But since we're here, can we go to page 321? Start at 318, sorry. Okay. Is that a copy of the so-called Venice Principles?
Yes.
And why are they called Venice Principles?
They are called the Venice Principles because they were drafted by the Venice Commission of the European Commission.
Okay.
Yes.
And it would be fair to say that these principles have now gained recognition worldwide via the instrument of the United Nations.
Yes. Actually, the background to the evolution of the Venice Principles is that initially, the Paris Principles were adopted by the United Nations as an instrument to help establish national human rights institutions throughout the world, and to also protect these institutions. So the Office of the Ombudsman was also included as a national human rights institution. But later on, it was thought that really the Office of the Ombudsman is not like national human rights institutions, because national human rights institutions receive complaints of human rights from any member of the public against any person or anybody that has infringed their rights. But for the Office of the Ombudsman, the Office of the Ombudsman is unique because it investigates the executive. So it was thought that it needs its own unique set of principles to protect the work of the Ombudsman, and hence the issue of the Venice Principles. But they were sent out to various regional bodies, Ombudsman bodies throughout the world to get input from everyone internationally.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Chairperson, if you forgive me. I think instead of, I just wanted to isolate one thing from the Venice Principles, but I'd rather deal with them. I mean, obviously, that introduction we won't repeat, but if I can just move back to, just to, so that we don't lose the, there's just one point I wanted to wrap up on the other topic we were busy with, and the security of tenure thing was just an example, but so I don't want to follow that now. So thank you for telling us where the Venice Principles came from. But I want to point out, to go back to this issue of independence and autonomy, the importance thereof in South Africa, which is, I think people just don't get. You have, in your earlier testimony, said that in some countries, and including this country, I think, the public protector is one of the qualifications in the legislation, is that they must, both in terms of salary and status and qualifications and so on, is regarded in the same level as a judge.
Yes, that is correct.
Yes. And that is also not a coincidence. I mean, it's not, we could say, is regarded as a chief of police, or we could use all sorts of examples. The fact that a judge is used as a reference point is not a coincidence. It's because these are both independent institutions, correct?
Yes.
And, well, in your case, you were even, the chair called it a promotion, but that's debatable, whether it's a promotion or a demotion. But you were recently asked to serve as a judge.
Yes.
Right. And if, okay, well, firstly, maybe just to make sure that the chair is not worried about what will happen to him when he gets to Zambia. Can we allay his fears that you have you decided to accept that position or not?
There were discussions back home, and it was pointed out that the Office of Ombudsman has got security of tenure, and it was much better actually to allow the office holder to complete the term of office before being considered for any other office. So happily the government acceded to that submission, and therefore I'm still the Ombudsman of Zambia.
So you escaped from the quote-unquote promotion for now?
Well, I suppose so.
All right. The point I really want to get to is a more serious one about what I say in South Africa. Unfortunately, there's a dire failure to appreciate this issue. It's about the independence of the Office of the Public Protector, in particular, vis-a-vis the independence of the judiciary.
Yes.
Our constitution is not confused about this. It's just human beings. It's actually uncanny. If you look at Section 165 of our constitution, I read this thing for so many since it was produced, but this just one of these days occurred to me. Shows you that you learn every day. If you look at Section 165(3) of our constitution, and 165(4). It's a pity, I don't know, Ketsepo is our IT whiz kid, if she can put the two to get to, on two different screens. Okay, she's not that much of a whiz kid, it turns out. But it's fine, we'll have a mental picture because we read the other one earlier. But for the sake of emphasis, Chair, if you allow me, I'm just going to read this out. You'll see that this is almost, it's a carbon copy of what I read to you earlier on Section 182, literally. This is what, it's just that the other one, this time the other one comes first and so on.
Yes.
So the first one is about functional autonomy that we're in. This is now in relation to the judiciary. No person or organ of state may interfere with the functioning of the courts.
Yes.
You remember we said earlier, 181(4), no person or organ of state may interfere with the functioning of these institutions. Literally, word for word.
Yes.
So the constitutional founders found it necessary to use the exact same words for the protection of the public protector in this case, and a judge.
Yes.
Okay. Then the next one, 165(4). Again, literally a carbon copy. And I don't think this was a result of laziness or of drafting. I think it was deliberate. So sending a message to us, which we have not internalized. It says, organs of state through legislative and other means must assist and protect the courts to ensure the independence, impartiality, dignity, accessibility, and effectiveness of the courts. You see, 182(3) is exactly the same, except that where it says the courts, it says here, yeah, these institutions.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, if the founders of the Constitution thought that these two institutions should be protected in almost an identical way, then why is it that there should be a difference when it comes to the actual protection? And I'm coming to something you said earlier. Remember my example about the two countries and what have you.
Yes.
As far as the judiciary is concerned, you said that
if the legislature has to get involved, it must be involved at the end of the process.
Yes.
And rather, if the suspension, we were talking about the suspension by the president, it should rather come at the end of that process.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, here in South Africa, this is what we're told. When it is a judge, this is common cause. You can take it from me, because I used to be involved in it. When it is a judge, you have an inquiry, much like this one. Okay.
Recording stopped. Recording in progress.
Okay. And only until the person has been found guilty at the inquiry may the president suspend. That's a
yes.
good thing.
Okay. Yes.
But here it is believed that in this case, the president may suspend before the finding of guilty, as it has happened to the person sitting here next to my right. Now, if we have this principle of, as I say, almost carbon copy protection by the Constitution, is which of the two systems is fairer? The one that's the protection given to the judge, by being only subjected to suspension after, or the one where you may be suspended before any finding of guilt against you?
The proper position, as stated in the O.R. Tambo declaration,
mm-hmm.
and the recommendations in most of the international instruments, is that at minimum the office of the ombudsman must be equated to that of a judge.
Uh-huh.
Now, what do they mean when they say it must be equated to that of a judge? It means that the terms and conditions of service of that office, as well as the powers of that office, must be equated to that of a judge. And this is not being implemented because, like I said, there is this contrast between civil law jurisdictions and common law jurisdictions. And I would wish that common law jurisdictions would take that on as well, because it would just these two principles, the principle that the report of the ombudsman must only have the effect of recommendations, and then the ombudsman's terms and conditions of service and powers must be equated to those of a judge, be it a judge of the High Court.
Mm.
That is the best case scenario, because first of all, the reports of the public protector will not be appealable to the courts of law.
Mm.
One, because they are recommendations. Two, because the public protector is equated to a judge. Yes.
Okay, thank you. All right, I can see you're eager to come to the real issue. I'm saving that for after lunch, which is the issue of whether the best system, as we all thought in South Africa, including myself, I must confess, whether the best system in reality is that which makes the outcomes, I'm trying to look for a neutral word, of the public protector binding, and conventional wisdom says that's a better system, or a system where it's just recommendations. And as I say, we'll come back to this because that's really the main thesis of your paper. But just to get it out of the way, from your analysis, is this thing that we believe
And maybe we did it because at a particular time we were after a certain individual. But is a system where the outcomes of the public protector are binding? Or rather, which one of the two systems where the public protector's outcomes are binding and where there are recommendations is more consistent with the notion of the independence and autonomy, safety of the public protector?
The concept of the ombudsman is based on the principle that because recommendations are not justiciable, to prevent the office of the ombudsman being subjected to unnecessary litigation and being subjected to unnecessary victimization, the reports of the ombudsman must have the effect of recommendations. That is the classical model. That is how it has been. It is the tried and tested model. That is how it has been from time immemorial. However, I fully understand that, of course, a lot of governments want to have the force of an enforcement mechanism given to the office of the ombudsman. But we already have law enforcement agencies in our countries. So when an ombudsman carries out an investigation, they can make recommendations that this particular matter must be transferred to the Anti-Corruption Commission. It must be transferred to the people who are in charge of money laundering. It must be transferred to this wing of government. So there are systems in place to ensure that the report of the ombudsman is taken seriously.
Okay. So which of the two systems, yes, I know it's lunch, sorry, Chair. We have a system A where it's the binding and another system B where there are recommendations. Which system? Okay, let me put it this way. Later on, I'll even say that we wouldn't be here if we had not had a system of binding remedial action. But that's a story for another day. But in your analysis as somebody who has experience in this field, who is an expert, who understands all the different models and you've given us all the comparatives, just directly, is the system where the outcomes are recommendations the better system qualitatively, I mean, taking into account all those things, or the one where there are binding outcomes or remedial action?
From my own experience, the classical model where the effect of the ombudsman's reports is mere recommendations is the better model. It's the stronger model. It entrenches independence for the ombudsman.
Thank you, Chair. On that note, that was just an introduction to the topic that I was saying I was saving for after lunch, but it came out so I thought I might as well lay the basis. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Advocate Mpofu. Thank you, Ms. Okoni, colleagues, for pause there for lunch and be back at 2:00. Thank you.
Thank you.
Recording stopped.
I guess that's